Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Sports Inquirer podcast, which is brought to you by thesportsinquirer.net, the premier site for news and notes in the world of sports. You can follow us on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word. Also on Facebook under The Sports Inquirer. And then finally, subscribe to us on iTunes. All of my podcasts from the very beginning are archived and on iTunes for you to listen to, so you can catch up on all the things we've been talking about over the past year or so. Also brought to you by thestartinglineup.net, another excellent sports site out of Chicago, Illinois. They actually have a weekly show on Saturday mornings. I recommend that you check it out. I was up in Chicago and did a show about 2 weeks ago. Really good experience and good people there working at the company. Okay, let's get to the show. All right, 2 weeks left in the NFL season, regular season before we get to the playoffs. A lot of activities going on out there in the world of the National Football League. Last week was an interesting week because I was actually able to sit back and see a lot of stuff that was going on in relation to local teams here in the Southeast and beyond. Atlanta should have lost that contest against the Washington Redskins at home. For those of you who aren't too familiar with it, the Falcons right now, expectations were at least a postseason berth, possibly a Super Bowl run, especially with the weapons they brought in on the offensive side of the ball. Everything's falling apart on offense and defense. Julio Jones injured for the season. Both lines have been extremely disappointing. We talked about this last week. When your team starts losing, and I've been there as a New York Giants fan, fortunately, not too much. They've been a pretty model franchise for the past 10 years or so. When your team starts losing a few games early in the year and you realize that the playoffs aren't going to happen, maybe it's the NBA mentality in me where tanking or maybe losing some games to improve your draft picks is talked about more openly. But when your team starts losing games, and like Atlanta has been, you get to the point where it's time to pack it in and think about next season for several reasons. One, especially in the NFL where it's a lot more slotted as far as your draft options and seem to be less flexibility with trades, the difference between having the second pick and maybe the fifth or sixth pick is huge. It may be the difference between you getting the offensive lineman that you really need and barely getting a defensive pass rusher that can be in your starting rotation. The stakes are that high. So I don't understand why the Falcons ended up winning that game or attempting to win that contest. And it's tough to tell a football player professionally that they can't go out and win because their jobs are on the line. But I think there are ways you can manipulate that, give some younger guys a shot. And I think the Falcons have kind of done that. You can go to the extreme end, and we'll get to Washington right now, who are a complete mess of it and who end up winning that contest. We talked about this last week as well with the Robert Griffin III benching or sitting him for the rest of the season and that trying to be proactive yet inactive at the same time. You're being proactive because you see that he health-wise is not where he needs to be and he has underperformed by his standards and what you should expect from a quality quarterback of his caliber. But then you also are being in a negative way by throwing Kirk Cousins in there, because if Kirk Cousins goes in there and throws really well, and he had a decent game against Atlanta, it wasn't a great game, but what's the benefit of putting Cousins in there just to play well? And some of you may say, oh, he could do well for the draft pick, but I think that's illogical thinking, because if anything, you're putting more pressure on Griffin if Cousins comes and does well. Sure, you may trade Cousins and get a decent draft pick for him, but then the fans will think, well, what if we just kept Cousins and why don't we get rid of Robert Griffin III? So that's where you get a lot of the drama with that. And Mike Shanahan, as I said, get his money. We talked about it as well. He got burned in his first head coaching gig in Oakland with Al Davis, where he was not fully compensated for his money after he was fired. So you know he is not going to leave Washington just to resign. He's going to get all of his money. And that's why you have not seen him resign. And he's pulling this hoax on the Redskins by throwing Cousins in there. When I did my outline a few days ago for this show, I said I was worried about Denver because they had a bad loss to San Diego. While I'm still kind of worried about them, I think in the end, that was a unique situation. It was a Thursday night game coming off of a short week. Denver had an emotional win, a difficult win at Kansas City the week before. So they had a short, they were home, so that did help, but it was still a short week with a roster, especially with Peyton Manning, some older players, and they just got beat by a hot San Diego team who actually is playing pretty decently this year. I think the way it shakes out in the AFC is Denver gets home field advantage. It's going to be very tough to beat them in Denver. Yes, we saw Baltimore pull that off last season, but that took a late touchdown throw by Joe Flacco, almost a miracle throw, to get that game into overtime. Denver's home field advantage is not as devastating or strong as Seattle's in the NFC side. But the way the AFC is shaking out, who's going to go into Denver and get that win? New England was a strong candidate, but their defense has regressed towards the middle part of this season. Losing Rob Gronkowski for the year eliminates their best offensive threat. So New England, I think, is out. Kansas City, a solid team. They're familiar with Denver. Maybe they can go in there and win. But I don't think they have enough offense really to hang with the Broncos on the road. You look at the rest of the setup, the Cincinnati Bengals, just when you want to give them have confidence in them, give them a chance to make that next step, they end up blowing that game at Pittsburgh on Sunday Night Football last week. So just going down the roster of all of the AFC teams, and the rest of the teams, between maybe Miami and San Diego, they did it, you know, just did it this past week. If they get into the playoffs, Baltimore. None of them, Indianapolis, none of them really inspire hope for me to go into Denver and win that game. So while I was concerned about that loss at home to an inferior San Diego team, overall I think they'll be okay. Philadelphia doesn't want it. How do you lose to Minnesota with Matt Castle playing, no Adrian Peterson or Toby Gerhardt on the Vikings, and end up with a loss when your roster is fully intact and ready to go? The NFC East, and as I said, as a Giants fan, it hurts to see that division play so poorly, but the reality is that division is the weakest I've seen it in 15, 20 years of following it. Sure, there have been times where the Redskins have been bad, the Cowboys have had their low moments, Eagles, inconsistencies, and then the Giants as well, the Ray Hanley years and among some others. But as an overall unit, that's probably the weakest I've ever seen that division. And Philadelphia had a prime opportunity to take advantage of some losses from other top contenders, mainly Dallas. And we'll get to the Cowboys at the very end of this segment. But it was one of those losses where you look at the rosters, you look at the setup. I know you're on the road, but that should be a winnable game. That instills no confidence in me. Whoever ends up going to Philadelphia for the first round of the playoffs, because they're not going to get the bye, whether it's New Orleans, Carolina, maybe even San Francisco, that's it. They're going to lose that first round game. So I have no confidence in the Eagles. San Francisco, who actually hosts the Falcons on Monday Night Football this week, I like what I keep seeing from them. We mentioned before, that first regular season game against Green Bay, Colin Kaepernick throwing for 300-plus yards, then rushed for more than 100. I think the coaches got enamored with that and tried to force Kaepernick to throw the ball more than he has to. But the 49ers going back to their old bread and butter, running the ball well, playing solid defense, Kaepernick with the read options. If they follow that formula, they're going to be a really tough out in the NFC. They're still my Super Bowl pick right now. In the preseason, I picked San Francisco to face Houston, which on Houston's side obviously was a massive miscalculation on my part. But I still have San Francisco as my Super Bowl team. I'm sticking with my pick, even though Seattle's looking really strong right now. I was wrong about Jay Cutler. When you're in this industry and doing your podcast and sports talk in general, you make a lot of projections. Sometimes you're right about them. A lot of times you're wrong. You're putting yourself out there. I admit when I'm wrong. And I think when we get to, you'll see more towards draft time when we get towards that. All of the draft picks I thought were going to be superstar players. The one I think of always is Ryan Leaf. I thought that the Colts should have taken Ryan Leaf over Peyton Manning. 15 years later, we see where that's gone. I was wrong about Cutler because I thought they should have stuck with McCown at quarterback for the Bears. They won some really good games. He looked outstanding, especially in the Dallas game, the Monday night game 2 weeks ago. And Cutler looked shaky in the first half against Cleveland. I know the end result of other people saying, oh, they won the game, that was a correct decision by Trestman and the Chicago Bears staff. But Cutler looked really shaky in that first half and should have had some more interceptions. But he made it through. He got better in the second half, which, and you saw the rust kind of wearing off. And he played well against the Browns. I still think Chicago, they'll probably win the division. Because Green Bay, they had that was an excellent win against Dallas on the road. Detroit, complete mess as well. They should have won that game against Baltimore. They're out of the playoffs. That last game of the season, Green Bay goes into Chicago, and I think that home field advantage, and Cutler having another game under his belt, that's going to be enough for the Bears to win the division right there. New England, I mentioned them already, very vulnerable. Tough loss to Miami on the road. A very winnable game, a game in the past that they would have come out with a victory. There's just something off about this Patriots team. Maybe it's Gronkowski being hurt and for the rest of the season. Maybe it's not having Wes Welker. The defense, which looked really good in the beginning of the year, and as a fantasy owner of that squad, they were putting up some nice points for me. But lately, it's been a struggle. It's just something off about that squad. So I have no confidence in them coming into the postseason. Similar to how I was wrong about Jay Cutler, I've been wrong about the Miami Dolphins. I thought after the incognito Martin offensive lineman hazing, bullying situation, that the squad would fall apart. And I'd never had confidence in Ryan Tannehill. Not as bad as Christian Ponder, who I never had faith in. But Ryan Tannehill, I just did not see a potential franchise player. And I still think he has his limitations, but he played the best game of his career against New England. 312 yards passing, 3 touchdowns, really performed at an incredibly high level at home in an important division game. New Orleans and Cincinnati look vulnerable on the road. We've seen New Orleans, the difference between them at home and them on the road. A lot of factors come to that. Offense is predicated on the pass. Playing in the dome really helps that factor. The defense takes advantage of the crowd noise when they're at home and plays a lot better with their blitz packages. They still should win that game in St. Louis. No excuses. It's a dome. It's all of the elements are there for the Saints to win that game. Yes, St. Louis has a solid defense. One of the top defenses statistically in the NFL if you break it down. But that's still a loss that the Saints are going to regret, especially having to go to Carolina this week. And I'm taking the Panthers in that one by at least a touchdown. Cincinnati. You're one of those teams where we look at Andy Dalton, A.J. Green, the defense, which is very strong. I know they lost Atkins, who was in the line to be defensive player of the year, I believe, in the first half of the year. but still a solid defense overall, especially on the front seven. That game that you lost against Pittsburgh, that's one of those statement contests where you go in there on Sunday Night Football, you dominate, you beat them up, and you make a statement, hey, we could be a contender for the Super Bowl. You don't go down 24-0 in the first half. That game right there shows me that not only are the Bengals not ready for primetime, maybe Marvin Lewis is not the coach to take them to that level. Marvin Lewis has done a respectable job, very good job, I think, considering the circumstances of the Bengals, if you consider what they were before he got there. And now we look at the Bengals as a playoff team, which for older fans like me, if you're in your 30s, especially even your 40s, the Bengals have been one of the worst franchises in the NFL during your entire fandom of the league. So respect to Marvin Lewis for getting them to this level of being a consistent playoff team. But it may be time for them to look and see what they can do to take it to the next level. They're not going to fire him. The Bengals are cheap, especially the Brown ownership. So he's not going anywhere. But that's the game you have to win. And then finally, Detroit and Dallas. Oh my goodness. The Dallas game is ad nauseum. We've seen what the blown lead, the Tony Romo interceptions, Dez Bryant walking off the field. I put it on my Twitter feed earlier in the week, and I'm still sticking with it. There will be no changes in Dallas. For all of the fans and pundits of the team, because they are a marquee franchise, the whole America's team, they're talked about more than anybody, so everyone has an opinion on them. Tony Romo's not going anywhere. Financially, they're committed to him for a really long time. He's a solid quarterback. Who else are you going to find immediately that's going to be an upgrade from him? They're stuck with them. They gave him the money. They had a chance to walk away from him a few years ago, but they signed him to the long-term extension, so they're going to have to deal with him and stick with him for arguably the rest of his career, or for the next 3-4 years. Jason Garrett's not going anywhere as far as the head coach. He's a yes man to Jerry Jones, and that's what they want in Dallas. Jason Garrett's going to say, yes, sir, no, sir, okay, coach, okay, owner Jones, I understand. He's not going to buck the trend. If you look at the Cowboys and their most success post Jimmy Johnson and Barry Switzer, who did win a Super Bowl with him, I give credit to Barry for that. The best coach they had there was Bill Parcells, because he would buck the trend against Jerry Jones. He would say no to him. And ever since Parcells got tired of that and got ran out of town, the Cowboys have returned to their ineptitude. The sad part about it, though, is that if they win their next two games, which is a possibility. Let's see, who do they have this week? They're at Washington, who's reeling. If they beat Washington on the road, which I think they will, they get Philadelphia at home in the last game of the regular season. They win that game, they're going to win the division and get a home playoff game. And that the cycle will continue for Dallas. Jerry Jones will say, hey, we won the division, we got a home playoff game, things are going right. And that's a major problem for that franchise. They print money, they keep it moving, and they're not going to win a championship under Jerry Jones' ownership as long as he's the owner. Whether he sells the team or, unfortunately, is not the owner for other reasons, which I don't want to get into a morbid discussion here, but he is not going to lead them to a championship. And that's just the reality of the situation if you are a Cowboys fan. So those are my thoughts on the NFL. If you have any other opinions, you always hit me up on Twitter, under Sports Inquirer. Send me an email, forgot to mention it earlier, undersportsinquirer@gmail.com. We're going to take a break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into the world of NCAA college football here on the podcast. finished up the regular season of college football this past week, or 2 weeks ago, actually. And now we're into the silly season, bowl season, and the changing of coaches. So we're going to delve into that right now. As far as the Heisman goes, no surprise here, Jameis Winston, he won the award. Really, probably the most dynamic performer this season for an undefeated, untested, or dominating Florida State squad. That's a recipe for an obvious Heisman winner. I personally would have voted for him to win the Heisman. Johnny Manziel would have been second. And third, I may have gone with Trey Mason just for the performances he put up against Alabama and against Missouri for Auburn in their two biggest matchups of the season. Surprised that A.J. McCarron got second. But it really doesn't surprise me. It surprised me, but it doesn't surprise me. It surprised me because I thought there were some other individual performers that may have had a better season than him and that lost to, not necessarily his fault, because he wasn't on the field for that big field goal kick return. I don't know if that's the proper saying of it, but that big field goal kick return for the Auburn against Alabama, he wasn't on the field for that, but that loss in their regular season finale really hurt his Heisman chances. So it surprised me that he got second, but it also doesn't surprise me because as we've seen with Heisman voters, they love giving that Lifetime Achievement Award acknowledgement. Now, it's gotten a little better over time. Obviously, the past three Heisman winners, or three of the past four, have been first-year starters between Winston, Johnny Manziel, and Cam Newton when he was at Auburn. So we've seen the Heisman voters give respect to first-year starters, freshmen. Winston and Manziel technically were redshirt freshmen when they won the award. So we've seen an improvement in that regard. But we still have those voters who like to look at the overall volume of the career, when I think the award should be for what that player did that year specifically. But McCarron's a high-profile guy, multiple national championship winner. You know, respect to him for his career, but I thought that was a little much, him being second in the voting. I put out there on Twitter and Facebook some topics that people wanted me to talk about, and one from Kayla, respect, doing her thing in Nashville, a good friend of mine. She wanted me to talk about the Texas opening, which of course I was going to delve into because I love this situation for what it represents in college football. And I'll hit on all of them when I discuss the opening. But between money, the prestige of the program, the name recognition, the celebrity status of that coach in the state and nationally, it's a really fun topic to discuss. Mack Brown should have been fired 3 years ago. I don't like calling coaches to be fired or things like that. I'm not a coach killer like some other of my sports talk brethren out there that call for a coach's head every time there's a bad situation. But in this case, he should have been let go. I don't have an ounce of sympathy for him. Very good coach. Won a national title. Those are very good things that you can never take away from his resume. They won only two conference titles in his 10-plus year tenure at Texas. That's inexcusable. Honestly, outside of Oklahoma, who do you really have to contend with in the Big 12? I guess, yeah, they've been in Big 12 the whole time he's been there. I know that we've seen some teams rise up and have their moments like Texas Tech and Baylor this year. Oklahoma State has become a top 20 program. Respect to all of them. But Texas should be a lot better than they've been under his tenure. Winning national championships, that's a tough thing to analyze because that's when you get to a national level and competing with all the teams. I understand that that's not necessarily achievable to win four or five national titles, which makes the Alabama era under Nick Saban even more incredible. But you got to win more conference titles at least for me than that. And that's when you see the Texas guys, similar situation in Georgia, especially on the defensive end. You see them in college, they kind of underwhelm, okay, whatever. And then they get to the NFL and they're balling, they're pro bowlers, they're contributors towards championship caliber teams. And it's like, where was that when he was in college? That comes down to coaching. Texas is in a very different situation than Tennessee a few years ago. I've seen that bantered around on Twitter, where this is very similar to when Tennessee fired Phil Fulmer and ended up hiring Lane Kiffin, and that was a disaster for 1 year. Then Derek Dooley, and now Tennessee is trying to rebuild and get their program back on track with Butch Jones, who I think is the right hire for them, and he'll get them to the levels that he can get them at, which I think will be very good for the Vol program. Texas has a lot more money than Tennessee. Tennessee financially is, and a lot like a lot of other programs, in financial trouble, at least of a year ago. Maybe they made some improvements, but financially they aren't able to offer the money to assistants and facilities and otherwise that Texas can. Now, Tennessee's not poor. They're not struggling. But in comparison to Texas, there's not much of a contest in that. Talent-wise, Texas can recruit the state of Texas, the Southwest, and cherry-pick some other players and have a top 10 program talent-wise. That's a given. That's all they have to do as far as their recruiting base to get top-flight talent into Austin. Tennessee, in-state talent is low. They have to go into Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, a lot of southeastern states, and even recruit nationally to get to the Texas level as far as talent goes. That's a lot harder to achieve. And then also, they're in a weaker conference. When Tennessee made that move, they're in the middle of the SEC. There are a lot of dogs and wolves and pit bulls in the SEC for them to compete with to not only get to a championship level, just to get to 500, get to respectability, maybe 7-8 wins. Every team in that conference has improved since the Vols fired Philip Fulmer. Vanderbilt's improved. Kentucky's improved. South Carolina's become a national championship caliber team. Georgia's had its moments. Florida has won 3 national titles since they fired Fulmer. And that's just on the East. If you look at the West, Alabama, LSU, Auburn, all national titles since the Vols have won theirs. So you look at the landscape of the conference, it's gotten a lot tougher. The Big 12, while it has its moments, it's really Texas and Oklahoma. Maybe Baylor can build upon this. TCU maybe has a chance to be respectable. Oklahoma State, as I mentioned, has been an improved product over the past few seasons. But Texas can get back to a national championship caliber level a lot quicker than Tennessee ever will, just because of the conference. All right, so who do they hire? That's the big question that all of us have been wondering. Andy North, when he does his golf coverage on ESPN before every major tournament, I guess it's Dr. North, he does a little segment where he gets these cue cards, and he looks at some analytics of who's going to win the tournament. And he'll do certain things like for like the U.S. Open, he'll say, for example, no one over the age of 50 has won the U.S. Open. So he eliminates all golfers over the age of 50. And then you look at some other stats like all the golfers that won the U.S. Open have been top 30 in driving accuracy. So he eliminates all the guys who don't fit that criteria. I'm kind of going to do a similar thing with this Texas opening. I think they hire a younger guy who's under 50 years old. I think they've gone from the Mack Brown situation, who's an older gentleman. They're going to go with some youth. They're going to go with a younger guy. And when I say younger, I'm saying under 50. Maybe 55. So they're going to go with that. They're going to go for a younger guy, and I'll get to why they're going to go with a younger person. Previous college head coaching experience. Everyone is talking about all of these guys like Mike Tomlin. I guess let me think of a few other guys that as far as who, John Gruden. Those guys are not going to be hired by Texas. They need a guy with college head coaching experience. Someone that could deal with the politics and the quote, politics. The head coach of Texas is a representative of the state. He has to do a lot of dinners, a lot of speeches, a lot of glad handing. He has to deal with all of that stuff. The Texas Board of Regents factor is overrated. But I think it should be acknowledged, though, as a factor in the process. We just heard that they hired an 8-man committee to go through this selection process for the head coach. That just shows the politics of the position, where the athletic director can't just say, I want this person. You interview, you speak to the candidate's agent or the search committee or search group, and you just make the hire and move on. It involves the governor, involves a lot of senators, a lot of politicians that are going to have their hand in what's going to be done as far as the head coach. But I also think it's overrated, because I think once that hire is made, the coach is going to have the autonomy to do a lot of his coaching skills. He's going to have the opportunity to do what he wants to do as far as head coaching goes. Now, as far as the hiring process, that's where the regents, I think, becomes a factor. Recruiting. Actually, let's make it take a step back. The Longhorn Network, I always want to say with the quote, politics. The head coach is going to be very comfortable being on camera. Have to be someone who's very willing to do a lot of coaching segments. Have a lot of access to his time to provide content for that network. Recruiting. Race may actually help a black candidate. We've seen the success of some African Americans or black head coaches recently in David Shaw and Kevin Sumlin. And while I don't really like to delve into race as being a major factor in a lot of sports, race being a major factor in sports, it is a factor of life. But I think it's overrated or blown up too much in its factor in sports. And that's another topic for another day. But as far as recruiting goes, I think it may help to have a Charlie Strong or James Franklin, a black man, a younger black man, to recruit some talent. I think parents and guardians, some of them look at race as a factor in relation to where they want to send their young man to go to school. So I don't think race is going to be a hurtful thing in this case. And you would think maybe with a high-profile position like Texas that they would not hire a black man. I think they actually may. Or if they're not going to say we're going to specifically hire him because he is black, but I don't think it'll be a deterrent. If anything, it may be a positive. But I think a bigger factor will be the head coaching college experience and the age factor. I think those will be bigger issues. Saying all that, who is out? Who is not going to get the position? Nick Saban's not going to get it. He signed that contract. He wasn't going anywhere with Alabama. I think he was just trying to flirt for a new deal extension, which he got. Job well done, Jimmy Sexton, his agent. He got it right. He's not going to go there. All the NFL guys are out. Jim Harbaugh, Pete Carroll, Mike Tomlin. All of those guys are championship caliber head coaches. All coaches who have either won a Super Bowl or been to a Super Bowl. Carroll has not been to a Super Bowl, but I think there's a very good shot he's going to get there with Seattle this year. All those guys are in franchises with strong ownerships, good ownerships. They're not going anywhere for the next 2-3 years. Beyond that, you never know. But they're going to get their shot at a Super Bowl. They're not going to walk away from that. Art Briles, I think, is out. That Baylor head coach. He brings the excellent offense. I'll give you that. And he's a Texas guy. A Texas coaching legend on the high school level. Coach Robert Griffin III. Got Petty now at quarterback. He's in an outstanding job for Baylor. I just don't think that he is going to get hired because he's too much like Mack Brown. And maybe I'm profiling here, but older gentlemen who I think would be more of the same with Texas. Now, he may be the safest pick, I'll give you that, as far as we had Mack Brown, we saw he works this way, a lot of success. We're going to bring in another guy who has a similar mold to him and with this great offense. So I think that's where he may get it, but I don't think he is. Another factor you have to realize, this is why Chip Kelly is out. Chip Kelly would have been an interesting candidate for the job, the current head coach of the Eagles. But despite Mack's lack of success or wins, as far as conference championship level or national championship level, he ran a clean program. I put clean in quotations because it's high-level Division I college football. I don't know if any program is necessarily clean anymore. But as far as NCAA sanctions and all that stuff, you never heard really a peep out of there outside of maybe one or two outliers through his tenure there. If Chip Kelly gets hired by Texas, there's a show cause. In essence, long story short, he's going to have a very difficult time getting a college coaching position over the next few seasons because of the rule violations that he had while he was at Oregon. I think same thing with Pete Carroll. I don't know what Carroll's situation is. Jim Tressel obviously has a strong show cause. That's why he can't be even an assistant at the college football level because of the situation he had at Ohio State with the end of his tenure there. So all the Chip Kelly rumors or trying to place him in that position, I don't think that happens. So who does get hired? I think their prime candidate is James Franklin. Obviously made Vanderbilt a respect beyond a very great program for Vanderbilt standards. Multiple 8-win seasons, third consecutive bowl trip. Fits the criteria. Younger guy, energetic, great in front of the camera. Will recruit his behind off in that state with better resources. If you want to bring the race factor, the black factor, that does help his cause. I think all of those reasons are why he's going to be a prime candidate for the position. And a lot of people talk about, well, he's too young for the position. He's not too young. It's not like he's in his 30s. And he's not a Cliff Kingsbury who's at Texas Tech, who is, I think, I may be older than him. Oh, no, he's a little bit older than me. I'm 32. But Franklin's been around. He's been an assistant coach at Maryland. Obviously, a success at Vanderbilt. I think he was an assistant at Kansas State. He's been at several positions. He's not a young buck as far as the coaching game goes. Charlie Strong will be a strong candidate. I guess pun intended or unintended there. He's been an excellent candidate for them as well. Head coach of Louisville. I think he's taken Louisville to its peak. Even though they're heading to the ACC, which I think is very vulnerable, outside of Florida State and Clemson, that could be a winnable conference. I think he would do a solid job there. Only two things with him. One, he's a defensive-minded guy, which I think in this era, you need a guy with some offense to take it to the next level. And James Franklin's an offensive guy as well. I need to mention that. So I think they may want to go a different route as far as their offense and defense, even though he's had Teddy Bridgewater, and he's had a very good career at Louisville. But I think they may want to go a different route. And then secondly, and maybe just because of snippets on camera, maybe with interviews and things like that, I just don't see him being very charismatic in the regard of the Longhorn Network and as far as trying to recruit the state and deal with all the, I said, a lot of speeches, a lot of dinners, things like that. I don't know if his personality fits that. Now, that may be nitpicking. If they hired him, that'd be a very good hire for Texas. But overall, I think those things that may hold him back. The last candidate that I have, who I don't see really mentioned too much, I saw it on one or two online sites, Bill O'Brien out of Penn State. NFL experience, coaching Tom Brady, he can sell that. College coaching experience, has done a very good job at Penn State, and Penn State, obviously, with the sanctions they've had against them, really have been crippling for that program. They've actually put together some solid seasons. Excellent head coach, excellent offensive mind. You see what he's done with Hackenberg, the young sophomore quarterback, and be a junior quarterback now. You've seen what he's done on that side of the ball. I've seen him do interviews and talking. He's really good personality as far as that goes. I've heard him do radio interviews here in Atlanta. He actually has a coach at Georgia Tech, so he does have a Atlanta background. I've heard him on the radio down here and seen him on TV. I think he has a really good personality that will fit a lot of things. Does he leave Penn State at this stage? I don't know. Especially when he has, I think, two factors for him as far as maybe staying in Penn State. One, I think their sanctions may be lowering, and that's going to help them maybe get into some bowl games. You can really get that program cooking in that regard. And then two, similar to David Shaw and Kevin Sumlin, I see those guys making the leaps in the NFL. I don't know if they're going to leave their jobs right now to go to a lateral position to another college football position. But when I see David Shaw, I don't think he leaves Stanford. He's got that program going well. He's an alum. Only way he leaves is for the NFL. Kevin Sumlin, Texas A&M, resources more than he can ever ask for. Yes, competing in the SC West is tough, but I think he's an NFL mind. Bill O'Brien, even more of that, because he has extensive coaching experience in the NFL on the offensive side of the ball. So those are my kind of thoughts on who they hire. If I had to do a coin flip and see who they pick, I think they take James Franklin. But it's Texas. You never know what's going to happen. But those are my thoughts on the position. And then finally, we have some bowl games coming up starting on Saturday. New Mexico Bowl, Colorado State, and Washington State. I'm going to go with the mascot battle. While I do like the Ram mascot, I'm a fan of Rams. I like the horns. I'm going to take the Cougar. Because if there was a battle in the wild of who would win that fight, I think a Cougar would beat the Ram. I'm going to have to do some YouTube research and see some animal fights. But I'm going to take Washington State to win that game. Las Vegas Bowl, Fresno State, USC. I take Fresno State. Bulldogs are very motivated. It's probably going to be Carr's last game at... It's going to be Carr's last game at quarterback for the Bulldogs. Trojans are going through a transition. They have Ed Ogeron, who was their interim coach. He's gone. Now they have Steve Sarkisian, who's their new head coach, but he's not going to coach the bowl game. There's a lot going on with that program. We saw what happened last year when they lost in El Paso to Georgia Tech in the bowl game. Why am I forgetting the name of the bowl? Anyway, it'll come to me. So they lost that game. Overall, I think the Trojans are going to be in trouble. Fresno, they're going to be very motivated beating the Big Brothers in California. Famous Potato Bowl, terrible name, terrible game. I'll take Buffalo, New York, represent. New Orleans Bowl, Tulane and Lafayette. Fun Louisiana battle. I'm going to go with Tulane. They haven't been in a bowl game in a very long time. Downtrodden program. They've made their moves, so I'm going to go with them to win that contest. All right, we're going to take another break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into the world of mixed martial arts here on the podcast. Welcome back to the show. I watched UFC on Fox last Saturday. Excellent program. Excellent profile for the smaller weight classes. I don't really, when I look at a fight card, I don't usually notice the weights as far or the weight classes that are going on. Once in a while, you'll notice, hey, you know, they have the top two fights, maybe welterweight fights, or I notice when the cards, now, especially with the UFC bringing women in, I'll notice if there's a women's fight in there. Just see the balance of what the UFC is trying to achieve. This past UFC on Fox card did not have one fight with a fighter over 170 pounds. I thought that was a really excellent move by the UFC to give the smaller weight classes a shot of displaying their skills. A lot of times it's tougher for guys below 170 to sell pay-per-views and to get the word out as far as the fights go. But I thought giving them a forum on free TV was really good. Demetrius Johnson making moves into my pound-for-pound discussion. And there's one thing I can guarantee. I know I've said it before as far as written content. There will be I don't know if I do a pound-for-pound, but there will be a power ranking of fighters on the sportsinquirer.net this upcoming week. I guarantee it. Especially before the Anderson Silva Chris Weidman fight, which is next Saturday, and we'll have an excellent preview of that as well. But if I did my pound for pound, Demetrius Johnson, he might be in my top five right now, especially with the retirement of another gentleman, which we'll get to. He will definitely be up there. Excellent first round TKO, Joseph Benavidez, for the flyweight crown. We've seen Demetrius Johnson where people complained or they critiqued him for not fighting an exciting style, especially against the Dodson fight, which was also about a year ago, won that by decision, and UFC on Fox. A lot of people said he made wins by decision, not really exciting. We've seen in the Madawa fight before this one, and now with Benavidez, he is really increasing his not only submissions but also his power. He's going for the finish, and that was an excellent knockout of Benavidez. And he is a guy who I think down the line, over the next year or two, while he, just because of the fact of his size and the weight class he fights in, he may not become that crossover figure like a John Jones or George St. Pierre or even Anderson Silva in that discussion, or Cain Velasquez when you consider his Hispanic background, especially with his Mexican heritage. He may not reach that superstar status or even like a Uriah Faber or BJ Penn as far as known guys, but he's going to make a nice niche for himself in not only the UFC but the mixed martial arts. And I said he's an entertaining fighter now, good personality, good look to him. I think he'd be a really good guy for the fight for be promoted in the future. George St. Pierre retiring. Once again, a few weeks ago, we talked about my disappointment in Dana White's reaction to George St. Pierre's emotional state after his close decision win over Johnny Hendricks. I was not surprised to hear St. Pierre retire. You have to realize that he has been fighting at the highest level in the UFC, or in general, for close to 10 years. I think his debut in the UFC was maybe around 2006, 2007. And ever since then, he has fought high caliber guys. When we look at fighters, we see the actual fight itself, fight night, and we think, oh man, that's their one night to shine. And they may only fight two or three times a year. So that's when they really have to get it up and compete. Fighting is a 24-hour, everyday commitment. From what you eat, to how you dress, to how you train. And it affects your personal life, your social life, your life. It affects everything. And to be at George St. Pierre level, championship level, maybe the best fighter in the world, to reach that level takes a tremendous time commitment. And he's talked about before, he's been open about it, so I'm comfortable talking about it, his, I guess, obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. He thinks he may have OCD or maybe an issue in relation to that. You combine all that together, that's very difficult to deal with as far as fighting goes. I understand why he left. And you have one or two guys on Twitter trying to be internet bullies, talking crap about St. Pierre. But no, tremendous fighter, competitor, gentleman of the sport. I think he'll come back. He's too much of a competitor. He loves the sport. I just think he needs to take a year off. I think you'll see him come back Super Bowl weekend 2015. That's my prediction. Maybe New Year's Eve, or yeah, the New Year's Day card for 2014. Super Bowl weekend 2015. I think he returns. And now that he returns to fight for the title against, that's a tough one. I'm going to say Johnny Hendricks. I think Hendricks ends up getting the title between the Lawler-Condon little potpourri situation that they're going to probably work out as far as who gets the interim title or permanent title, depending on how they want to phrase it. But I still think St. Pierre comes back eventually. But he's taking some time off, and good for him for that. Finally, his little add-on. I think it's Invicta, or no, it's not Invicta. I don't know what the name of the promotion is in Brazil, but apparently they're trying to fight a man versus woman in a fight. Very bad decision in that regard. I know they may weigh the same weight, but just the structural difference between a man and a woman, it should not happen as far as physical combat goes. Are there certain sports that men and women could compete against each other? Possibly. And you can come up with your own list of that. But as far as sports with physicality, when it comes to, I think, professional football, ice hockey, and combat sports, which I think are three of the most physical sports or top-level sports that I can think of right now, those sports, you cannot have men competing against women. Now, should the UFC, should women have their own division or own weight class, even their own promotion? Absolutely. And I love watching women fights. I think they're very entertaining. The strategies and techniques are very solid. I enjoy watching the fights. But for them to compete against a man against a woman, I cannot have that. And I don't want to, and then if you find a woman maybe 160 pounds and put her against a man maybe 120 pounds, could that negate the difference? No. Just the physical differences are too much. Or if you find a woman who's a world champion, fought dozens of fights against an amateur, should that happen? No. I don't think that should happen either. And I'll see what happens with the Athletic Commission. And I said, as of Friday morning, that fight is still happening, or they're trying to get it to go. I've been to Athletic Commission meetings here in Georgia. They actually look at the records of the fighters in determining if they should actually fight against each other. If you have a fighter who's 7-0, undefeated, compete against some really solid amateur background in boxing or wrestling or whatever it is, and you have that 7-0 fighter competing against a guy who's 0-2, no amateur experience, that fight is not going to get approved, or shouldn't get approved, if it's a respectable commission. Similar thing with here in Brazil, and obviously internationally, I don't know how they operate as far as commissions go, as far as their sports, but I don't think that's a fight that you should have take place overall. So those are my thoughts on that. We're going to take our last break here, and when I come back, I'm going to hit on some miscellaneous topics and then get to what ruffled my feathers here on the podcast. Welcome back to the show. Your host, E. Marcel Portun, on a beautiful Friday morning. Trying to mix up my podcasts. Usually I do them on evenings, but I'm trying to do it in morning, trying to mix it up and get some morning shows in as well. I actually like the morning. I got a little more energy. I was going to record the show last night, man, but to be quite honest with you, just a rough day at work. Nothing major, but part of my job requires me to travel kind of to different locations. I had a really bad one yesterday. Had to go into Douglasville. I pretty much put about 100 miles on my car just driving, and I was just wore out and grinding, and we've all been there. You know, we like our jobs, but sometimes we love our jobs, but sometimes you get one of those days, man, where it's just you want to just have some quiet moments and calm down, and that's what I did last night. I took some time to myself, relaxed, had a nice dinner, watch some Impact Wrestling, some basketball, and I feel a lot better now. It's going to be a good day. Weekend's coming up. It's holiday season, man, and you know, we're going to get next episode as well, besides my power ranks for MMA, we're going to get some holiday stories, some holiday memories into Portute Gray household, and I have some doozies, so looking forward to getting to that. But miscellaneous notes from the world of sports. Adrian Broner, he's going to be fine. Tough loss last week. Still a young guy. I think he's under 25. A little too cocky for my taste. If you're going to have that much, try to get that much swagger and be that cocky, you got to put up better performances. He's a good fighter, though. He's a young prospect. He'll be okay. Kobe Bryant out 6 weeks with a knee injury. Age. That's just the reality of him. Kobe Bryant, one of the greatest players of all time. Legend, Hall of Famer, 5-time world champion. He's just old. Came back from the Achilles injury, worked his butt off, outstanding. He's just breaking down. We look at it and say, Kobe, he's 35, which in other generations of basketball, he'd have a good solid 5-6 years, especially the way he works, maybe 2 or 3 years left. he's done as an elite player. He's still going to produce his points just because he knows how to score. He gets the benefit of the doubt from referees. He has an excellent mid-range game. So he's never going to average like 10 points a game and regress to that level. If he ever got to that, he would just quit and retire. But he's going to play out the next 2 years of his contract at $20-plus million a year, which I did not like at the time. I know what he brings to the box office, sure, if you look at it from that perspective, yes. But as far as on the court, that's very dicey. But he's just out because he's old. I mean, knee injury. He'll come back from this one. He's going to have another one. It's just what it is. The Spurs beating the Warriors last night. That was crazy. The Spurs, who, man, once again, are the best team in the West. It was really good to watch those two games last night because you're Oklahoma City. They beat up on Chicago, a Chicago squad who, health-wise, they're just shot. Their season's done. And then you saw San Antonio, who sat out Manu Ginobili, Tony Parker, and Tim Duncan, and still won that contest at Golden State. The Warriors, who I said could be a conference final team, man, they gotta win that game. Iggy's back in Iguodala. You got Curry, Klay Thompson. They're up and down running. Andrew Bogut, he's playing right now with relatively good health for his standards. You gotta win that game at home. I gotta see more from Harrison Barnes. You cannot have, I think he had 3 points in that game. You gotta produce more for me in that regard. Golden State, that's a bad loss for them. Kayla wanted me also talk about the baseball collision rule. I guess the new rule now is players cannot barge into home plate like we've seen in the past. As far as a runner, you know, coming from third base and just charging into the catcher. Once again, just saving Major League Baseball is taking a note from the NFL. NFL, we've seen all the rules and regulations get headshots and protecting their players, I think, for future situations. So that when players come back and say, I have concussions, I have head injuries, I have major brain trauma, life-threatening or life-altering injuries post-playing, the league can say, hey, we were proactive in trying to protect the players. Same thing with Major League Baseball. A few years ago, we saw Buster Posey break his leg in a, you know, really gruesome-looking injury at home plate with his collision, and he was catching for the Giants. Major League Baseball is trying to protect their butts, cover their ass, you know, definitely, with that rule. So I personally don't mind the rule. I think those collisions are a little much. For a sport that, for the most part, does not have physical contact, outside of maybe trying to break up double play, maybe interaction as a player, and maybe a tag, as far as players touching each other, you have all of that, and then all of a sudden, the one time you can just get all your rage out and your aggression is when you're tackling a catcher trying to knock the ball out. I think that's just a juxtaposition of your game, and a smart move by Major League Baseball. I agree with that. Oh, my boys, the Gunners, Arsenal looked bad against Manchester City last Saturday, or Sunday, last weekend. They lost 6-3 on the road, you know, to Manchester City. They're still in first place, but Liverpool, City, Chelsea, and even Everton, they're lurking to try to take that top spot from Arsenal. It's probably the most wide-open English Premier League race I've seen since following the league in the since the mid-90s. It's not the best league. I think Spain has had a really strong year. Germany has had its moments. Italy, it's okay. But as far as entertainment goes, it's probably the best league, and a lot of scoring. You're seeing 3-4 goal games from one team, very rare in soccer. So I think that Arsenal, I want them to win the league so badly. I'm still going to stick with my original pick and pick Chelsea to win the league. But Manchester City, if they keep their form on the road, even respectable, they're kind of like the New Orleans Saints of the EPL, where at home they look so good. All those guys are scoring at a high level, but when they get on the road, they just play a different game. I don't know if it's mental, physical, whatever, but City is going to be a major contender. Not surprised at all that Andre Villas-Boas was fired by Tottenham. They lost 6-0 on the road to Manchester City and lost 5, that was earlier in the year, and then this past week lost 5-0 at home to Liverpool. He won big at Porto, won the Europa League. But you saw him struggle at Chelsea and now at Tottenham. I think he's a guy who, under 40 years old, young guy, the game is just above him at the highest level. And you just see that tactically, what he tries to do. You see with the substitution patterns and starting lineups. Just one of those guys who's a young guy, potential big talent in the world of football coaching, but Tottenham was not the spot for him. He'll do well somewhere else. He's not going anywhere, but wise firing by them. And yes, Tottenham in general disappointment, and I think expectations were mixed for them. They sold Gareth Bale, who arguably was the best player in England last year, and maybe one of the top young players in the entire world. They sold him to Barcelona. Excuse me, not Barcelona. They sold him to Real Madrid. And they actually increased their payroll by bringing other guys in, and they've actually regressed. So that's why they fired him overall. I'm starting to get interested in the Olympics. I was watching some curling last night and two nights ago. Curling is my sport. My favorite sport as far as the Winter Olympics go is the hockey, the ice hockey. That's my favorite. But I'll mess with some luge and bobsled or skeleton. I love some luge. I like watching those guys, men and women, go up and down that course. I don't mess with the figure skating. That's just, I can't. And respect to their athletes, they do their thing. I just can't co-sign on that as far as watching it. But curling, I love shuffleboard on ice, the strategy of it. It's a boring sport, but for some reason, it really entraps me. Starting in the new year, I'll delve more into the Winter Olympics, and we'll do a lot more content on it. So if you have any sports particularly want me to talk about when it comes to the Winter Olympics, or Olympic sports in general, you know how to contact me. All right, let's end the show. We ruffled my feathers this past week. In the past, when I've done this segment, I've talked about what ruffled my feathers in a negative way and getting mad and angry. I talked about personal space. I've talked about different media personalities, and I went off on Joe Paterno and the Penn State issue. This one is not necessarily a negative ruffling my feathers, just more of an acknowledgement of the power of the viral media in 2013 in two cases. The Beyoncé new album, I've not listened to a Beyoncé song intentionally in probably 5 years. Only time I've actually acknowledged Beyoncé as an artist is when she performed the Super Bowl, I guess this past year or 2 years ago. Outside of that, she's been completely outside of my radar. And nothing against her, I'm just not a fan necessarily of her music. She's okay. But I respect her game in taking control of her product. If you don't know, she released, I guess, her full-length album this past week on iTunes. The media attention she got from that was incredible. And I look at the breakdown of it as far as her controlling more of her product and getting more of the intake of the money, doing it this way instead of pressing an album and releasing it on CD or whatever. Past artists like Neil Young, Metallica, Prince have had to do throwaway albums and odd albums to get out of bad record deals. And now we see Beyoncé using the power of the internet to have a platinum level album probably within by the end of this calendar year. So respect her hustle for taking advantage of this medium that we have in 2013 going into 2014. And as a music fan and respecting the old school artists and hearing all the bad stories of their record deals and struggling to get their product out and having labels hold their albums from being released for sometimes years at a time. Seeing a Beyoncé do her thing and releasing her album immediately straight to the masses, I respect that. I love seeing that as someone who follows the music industry. So good for her in that regard. Megyn Kelly, debating about Santa and Jesus being white. Once again, similar to Beyonce as far as following what goes on in her world, outside of being in the gym and seeing Fox News, you know, playing in the locker room, I really don't mess with that station. I don't mess with news stations really that much in general. So it's not a political thing, you know, making a Fox News versus CNN conservative liberal debate. I don't really delve into that much anyway on a personal level. I get my news through other sources. But the fact that this actually became an issue on the internet, and the only reason I saw that was because Jon Stewart of The Daily Show, a show that I do watch quite a bit, went off and put the ether on her as far as debating two fictitious characters and actually trying to take it very seriously. Santa's a made-up character. If you're a young kid, first of all, if you're under the age of 15 listening to this podcast, respect to you, but Santa's not real. And then Jesus, that's once again another debate for another day. But it's a figure that if you're going to believe that existed, race really should not be a factor in your belief in him, if you catch what I'm saying. I don't understand how you can have a debate of who's white, who's black. I've heard that Jesus is a black man, especially me being black and growing up in church, and that's always been a sensitive issue. But the fact that this became a discussion, I'm talking about it, once again, shows the advantage of taking advantage of viral culture. She knew exactly what she was doing, Megyn Kelly, putting the stuff out there, and now she's kind of apologized but hasn't apologized. This is exactly what she wanted for her show. I'm talking about her, and many others have been talking about her as well, and that's just her taking advantage of the internet media. You listening to this show right now shows the power of viral nature and the power of the media. 10, 15 years ago, I would have had to be hired by a radio show and go through the grind of all of that stuff just for you to hear my voice and hear me discuss sports and other topics in the world. I'm literally in a room right now with two computers and a little mix board talking to you out there throughout the entire world. And that just shows the power of the internet and power of technology. And those, Beyonce and Megyn Kelly, while for different reasons and in some unique ways, showed that power, and I love it. So that's what ruffled my feathers in a positive way this past week. Once again, thank you for listening to the show. It's been Emarcel Portu. I've had a blast talking to you. Have an excellent weekend. Happy holiday season. We're going to try to churn out a show before Christmas, so probably Monday or Tuesday. If I don't churn out a show, or if you listen to this after that, have a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays. Respect to all of you out there. Be safe on those streets. And until we meet again, good fight, good morning, and good night.